Jesus and power, this effort to explore both of those terms a bit and put them in conversation with one another, referring both to the power experienced by people in Jesus' presence and to the realities of power in ours. This morning we spent some time talking about our era as a new era in human history with a novel range, novel quantity, novel consequences, novel marks of power. This evening, the question is not, is it a new era of human power, but is it a new era of God's power? Now, the question may strike you as a bit odd. Even if human power has changed shape and form in our era, isn't God's power always the same? I want to reply with an unambiguous, maybe, maybe not. We shouldn't expect continuities, for sure. But we might also be facing some new experiences and understandings and modes of God's power. And it's that element of discontinuity amidst what I'm sure are continuities that I want us to focus upon. And I first want to make the case that we ought to expect a new era of God's power and different forms of God's power on the basis of Christian faith itself. Our faith ought to lead us to look for and expect that. Both Judaism and Christianity are historical religions. That is to say, historical events carry religious meanings. Historical events, we claim, bear the very presence of God. So a creed like the Apostles' Creed gets very concrete. Suffered under Pontius Pilate. Didn't happen on some ahistorical plateau. Certain date, certain place, certain time. Historical events bear religious meaning and carry God's presence and are the place of the working out of God's purpose. So we remain, as Jews and Christians, to my knowledge, have always claimed, open to changing history as the place of revelation itself. To say that God is a living God, present in a dynamic history, moving to a place the world's not been before, means to affirm with Isaiah God's claim to be doing now and then a new thing. So I'm just trying to legitimate my question here. I'm trying to say it's not odd at all, but somewhere near the heart of Jewish and Christian faith. Israel's experience of God's power was not the same as a nation state, as was Israel's experience of God's power in the Exodus. Israel's experience of God's power was different in exile than it was in the land. Israel's experience of God's power was different in diaspora than it was in exile. It was different in biblical times than it is in the experience of God in the state of Israel today. Luther's experience of God's power in the Reformations was a different experience of God's power, and they would have said, I think, a different mode of God's presence from the early churches. We live on this side of the Enlightenment. We understand God's power differently than, say, medieval Christendom. God, so to speak, after Marx and Freud is different from God before Marx and Freud. So I'm trying to legitimate the question, is ours a new era of God's power, and put it to you, how do we experience and understand God in our kind of world, in our age, where there are some distinctive marks of a changed scene with respect to human power. Now, for the sake of provoking discussion, and I'm going to quit talking at 20 minutes past the hour, no later than that, I'm going to introduce you to another Orthodox Jew. Last night I introduced you a little bit to Pinchas Lapid on the Sermon on the Mount. Tonight I want to introduce you to Rabbi Irving Greenberg, New York City, who with Elie Wiesel founded the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership and runs it. I wish I could commend a book to you by Rabbi Greenberg, but if he's published some, I don't know what they are. I do know that he writes regularly in a journal entitled Perspectives. It comes from the center that he operates, and I put the address up there in case you are interested in some of the materials to which I point. And I'm going to share some snippets from just one issue of Perspectives, an issue by Rabbi Greenberg entitled The Third Great Cycle of Jewish History. It's about God and power in Jewish history, with a bold interpretation of the character of God's power in our time. And he's talking about Jews. You'll easily make a transfer to Christians and perhaps to the situation and religions in general. If you are not stirred by this, if you're not provoked by this, I want you to promise me one thing. Either check your pulse or mine, because one of the two of us is dead and we just expired without noticing. Rabbi Greenberg says there are some continuities across three great cycles of Jewish history, some continuities of the presence and power of God. Absolutely basic to Judaism throughout all these, its entire stretch of history, is its central message. The central message of Judaism is the ultimate triumph of life and good over evil and death. The ultimate triumph of life and good. Shalom, a good Hebrew word, for all of creation. A final triumph of harmonious and abundant ordering of the things of the world. So history has a telos. History has a goal. As Rabbi Greenberg so nicely puts it, we will see humans as the image of God in a world structured so as to sustain that image. It's a lovely theological sentence. We will see the image of God reflected in humans in a world structured so as to sustain that image. We get glimpses of it now, but the world is not structured to sustain the glimpses of harmony and justice, of love and peace that we do have and do taste and do live from. Like Christianity, this ultimate triumph of life and good is a hope. That is a statement of our faith. And Greenberg's sentence here is so rich, I'm going to quote it. For Jews, a hope is a dream which has accepted the discipline of becoming a fact. A hope is a dream which has accepted the discipline of becoming a fact. And the human project with God is to change the hope that is a dream into a fact, and to take on the discipline that's necessary to do that. How does that hope become a fact? I'm still sketching what he sees as the continuities throughout the three cycles. By way of a covenantal process, a co-creating interaction of God and creation in history. God's power is already shared in creation itself, and we are the bearers, along with our co-siblings of creation, of God's power, and partners with God in a covenantal process to try to see that this hope, which is a dream, become a fact. It has to happen in ways appropriate to our creatureliness, appropriate to our finitude. As he puts it, it has to happen on a human scale, the world becoming a place of harmony. It has to happen on a human scale. Then there's a wonderful treatment of the flood in this this writing. Now, I'll just, as an aside, mention my rather much fascination with a number of Orthodox Jews, because you have, on the one hand, such a serious wrestling with the text, tending to literally every jot and tittle of the sacred text, and on the other hand, just enormous freedom with that text to interpret it in all sorts of ways. It would drive Christian fundamentalists among us absolutely crazy in the interpretation of freedom, but the seriousness of the wrestling with the text is there. So here's an interesting interpretation of the flood. The flood represents, tells us, of God's anger at the escalation of human violence, injurious to creation. Human beings are destroying a creation that is to be through history on its way to shalom. And in a fit of anger, God calls forth the watery chaos all over again, that which was present before the creation out of chaos. God calls forth the watery chaos again, virtually undoes creation, kills virtually the whole lot with this terrible drowning. Greenberg says, God forgot human scale and human finitude and creatureliness, and God had to learn how to deal with humans. God made a big mistake and learned from the mistake. God decided that this, namely the flood, was no way to get people, to change people, and promised never to do that again. And ended up saying, listen, folks, after this, you can count on me. Nature will be orderly. There will be seasons and springtime and harvest, and we can get on with the project toward a full harmonious creation. I repent. I've got to take into account better who you are, the kinds of creatures you are. Now, interestingly enough, God has made that promise. It's we human beings who threaten chaos in the form of a fire to undo creation. So it's not God's power that threatens the created order any longer. It's human power via, as James Baldwin, this comes from an old English spiritual, says, God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water, the fire next time. But Greenberg is saying, God's made God's peace with the created order. Now it's up to us to make ours. All right. So in brief, and talking about the continuity throughout all the cycles of Jewish history, you have a goal, that is the world structured as so as to sustain the image of God in it. A process, namely covenantal co-creation, but a process that will change. Trajectories of the past will need to be altered to reach the goal. The human story, the chapter in the human story will go on, and we'll find out that we mess it all up and something else will have to come along. And Rabbi Greenberg says, it's the vocation of Judaism to always spawn messiahs. The messiahs are the breakthrough people that take history in a new direction. Jesus was one of the messiahs. The messiahs make the mid-course corrections. And Judaism has the vocation of spawning messiahs until the final triumph of life and good. All right. Now, Moving quickly then through the three great cycles to get to the modern time and God's power and presence in our time. First cycle is one familiar to us, biblical Judaism. We're familiar with the Hebrew Bible and the Jewish religion as the elder sibling of Christianity. In this time of biblical Judaism, Greenberg says, God is the power. God is the liberator of the people, a slave people who had no power, from Egypt against mighty Pharaoh. God is a voice on the mountain. Mount Horeb goes up in mist and smoke just to get their attention. God is a judge of the nation. God tosses the nations into the bread oven. This is the God of the mighty acts of nature and the mighty acts of history. Humans are covenantal partners all the way through, but God is the great power. Human power is not only derivative, it's minuscule compared with the power of God. Even when the Hebrews celebrate the great place of humanity in the created order, think of Psalm 8. When I survey the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have established, what is humanity that you give thought to us? Even when there is a celebration of that, it's a celebration in humility that we are such small and fragile creatures, dust of dust, and God is the great power. Okay, that's biblical Judaism. Rabbinic Judaism is the second in the great three great cycles. You may have been here for Paul's session. You know that Rabbinic Judaism was twin-born with Christianity. The Pharisees movement spawned the rabbis. The Messianic Jews followed one of the rabbis, Jesus. Here, God and humans continue to be co-creators, and if you will, God's power is more dispersed, says Greenberg, in human power, and it is to be seen in more understood in more secular ways. Sacred locations of power are gone now. The temple is gone. It's destroyed. The land is gone. The diaspora takes place. And Jews live in communities here and there dispersed throughout half the civilized world or more, with the rabbis and the congregations at the center of it. The rabbis are teachers. They're not really quite clergy in our sense, and there isn't that notion of priesthood any longer in the location of God's power with sacred places and mediated through the priesthood. Jews learned co-creation with God, learned that it could and did happen in diaspora in secular ways. Now I'm moving quickly because I have a covenant with you. The third great cycle, post-Holocaust Judaism. That genocidal effort to extinguish a people of God was nearly successful. And many lessons were learned. I'll mention only a couple, three to be precise, from Rabbi Greenberg. I'm just skipping over too much. One is that innocent suffering of itself is not redemptive. If that's what Christians mean by a theology of the cross, it is untenable for Jews. Innocent suffering by itself is not redemptive. Millions of innocent people were killed, and there was no redemption in it. Secondly, the God of saving, intervening power doesn't exist. Didn't show. Thirdly, rather than the God of saving intervening power and the redemptive power of innocent suffering. Rather, God's power in our time is hidden and dispersed in, with, and under human power. Humans can use it in godly ways. Humans can also defeat God's dreams for all of creation, at least all of creation within our reach. That there's a shift in power, so that God's power is in fact hidden among us in our power in secular arenas, that is to say, in the everyday uses of power, in family, between friends, between enemies, in economic, political, international life, etc. And there, God struggles as a co-creator for morally responsible and historically humane use of our powers. God still is there as co-creator in a covenantal relationship, but now God struggles in the form of human power for the fullest possible flourishing of creation. God's power is real, but it's bound, in our corner of the universe anyway, to human power, such that we can actually destroy or we can actually enhance God's own ends and purposes. Hell is a four-letter word beginning with H, like Hiroshima and Holocaust, and it represents enormous destructive potential in our hands, that is, human power, enough to defeat God's dreams for this patch of cosmic real estate. It also represents power for seeing one's way to the realization of God's own dreams. So, to the question, is ours a new era of God's power? Rabbi Greenberg's answer is yes. An era in which God's power is more and more dispersed and hidden in, with, and under human power. I want to quickly add, he is not about to deny the presence of God in non-human creation, but he wants to say, where is the location of that critical power to see creation move toward the goal? And that is more and more in human power, because it all of creation, like Hegel says, in the modern era, nature is sucked up into history. Human history even determines the fate of nature in larger and larger measure. So God's power is more and more dispersed and hidden in, with, and under human power, and that human power is of such magnitude and consequence so as to both imperil or realize our co-creator's dreams. I'm going to say it a couple more ways and then I'm done. After the Holocaust, Jews and we can no longer claim that goodness is omnipotent, or that the triumph of goodness is a certainty, even when we assert that God struggles for the triumph of life and good. And Greenberg, as an Orthodox Jew, says both those things. God struggles for the triumph of life and good, and the certainty of that triumph is, because of human power, rendered doubtful. God is not impotent, Greenberg says, but God's potency is suffused into human power in the secular life. Or I'll say it in the words of a Christian theologian now. I'm citing Carter Hayward's book, The Redemption of God. She's talking about Elie Wiesel, Rabbi Greenberg's co-founder of the Center for Learning and Leadership. Wiesel's message to me as a Christian theologian is that if there is to be any redemption of humanity from evil in the world, it is up to us. We can never again abdicate our responsibility to an omnipotent deity. If God is omnipotent, it is in and through the power of human love. Only if we take humanity seriously on humanity's terms may God be delivered with us from evil. Only if we take human power seriously on the terms of human power that we have, may God be delivered with us from evil. The title of the book should have struck you, The Redemption of God. All right, now, do you have a pulse? Huh? I want to know what people's response is to Greenberg or to Hayward, or Bonhoeffer said much the same thing. Are we talking here about monumental heresies? Or are we talking about a new era and mode of God's power?
Is there any biblical basis for that kind of assertion?
Rabbi Greenberg says yes. But that's within, again, this Jewish notion that both the Bible speaks truth and history is a place of ongoing revelation of God beyond the closing of the biblical canon.
I guess would be claiming that the Bible speaks proof only for that first phase, because the second and the third are post-biblical. The one is rabbinic and the other is modern.
But
isn't that right, that we really are able to conclude that God is now present through human agency in the modern, not on the basis of the Bible, but on the basis of realities that have unfolded since
yeah.
the Bible?
Yeah.
My only problem with that is that I think that sense of God's being present in the creative and redemptive process through human agency is very biblical too. I mean, what is Israel? What is Abraham's blessing? And what is Cyrus? I think that his orthodox reading of the Bible, which takes literally, you know, the column of fire and smoke and
yeah.
the voice on Sinai,
yeah.
maybe is the difference between his reading of that stage and mine.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I would see that it is, as Israel's language, we're describing the same thing. She encountered God's presence in her human experiences and saw God's purposes promoted in the world through her covenantal response and obedience.
Mm-hmm.
If it were disobedience that inhibited God's purposes, the same as he's attributing in our present day. So I don't see I believe what he says of the modern day,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's much more true to the biblical period, and if we would insert in that, now where does Jesus and the early Christian
mm-hmm.
movement belong, along with what I was suggesting late this afternoon, the model of Jesus is certainly not of the omnipotent God changing everything, but the God involved in human realities and certainly very much dependent upon and using human agency. So I think I see one ontology over the entire period.
You don't see his change in the relationship of God's power and human power, then?
No. I don't think I see it nearly as dramatically anyway.
Uh-huh.
I know other theologians that have tried to do that, but, you know, in Isaiah 24, where God destroys the earth, it's because of humans breaking the covenant and polluting the earth.
Yeah.
It's not because God is in control and decides this is the final time to clean it up and destroy it all. It's because humans have mucked up in their partnership.
Mm-hmm.
That's what covenant, I think, is all about
yeah.
in the Old Testament.
Yeah. And that continuity he carries all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Covenantal co-creation is the continuity all the way
mm-hmm.
through. All through the three cycles.
Yeah.
But he does see God's power, and again, I'm grateful for your remarks because it's over against his reading of his own tradition. He does see God's power as more and more hidden
yeah.
And more dispersed and less located with any specific even people. I mean, Jews sort of tell people that this is the God,
mm-hmm.
but God's power is throughout. Yeah.
hear you saying, because I think that it diminishes that.
Well, yeah, but it's also Christians who are saying. Well, how does it diminish God? I guess that's one question, and then the other question is. It's diminishing. Is it true or not?
How much different would that testimony be if he was a Jew converted to Christianity?
Well,
about God's power, feeling God's power in his life.
I mean,
wouldn't it be different?
It's hard for me to answer that, but it mustn't be different in a way which denies the reality of the Holocaust. You must come to terms with great pits of burning children. You must be able to, any word you say about God has to be a word that's credible in the face of pits of burning children.
I don't like what I see in some of our power.
Yeah.
Okay.
And neither does Rabbi Greenberg. Yeah.
Okay. And so it threatens me to think.
Yeah. Me too.
That God should be caught up in this as well as man.
Yes. I don't want to be responsible for the redemption of God, just between you and me. It's not ridiculous, because you have to ask, what is the character of human power in our era? And how far does it reach? And what is at stake there? Yeah.
Along that line, this seemed to lead me to thinking of far in the future.
Yeah.
The Old Testament is way back, and we're going through a long period of history. And the Holocaust is in there, and it could be even a warning if we see this all in perspective. We're close to nuclear fission.
Mm-hmm.
We're close to complete destruction. We had destruction there, but we're close to complete destruction if we don't take these warnings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel that God is there, and this was horrible, but it could be even more horrible if we don't see this entire picture.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's scary. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think so. But it still devolves back upon us to then make the move.
Yes, that is the warning.
Yeah.
But maybe through this warning, God is still there.
Yeah.
Not really in us. Mm-hmm. These things are happening in us, but God is still there. We're not going to destroy him. We might destroy ourselves unless we heed this warning.
Yeah, of course, Greenberg isn't saying really destroy God as much as God's dream for creation.
Can he be everywhere? I mean, God is everywhere. And he's in the people and he's not in the people. He's big.
We have a choice. We can either be obedient to God, or we can be disobedient to God. If we're disobedient, we're in hell. And if we choose to go ahead and burn up people and children, that's disobedience. And it's our choice, and we take the consequences.
I've got no argument with that. I do want to get into the question of what, if we hold this kind of power now in our era, and if so much is at stake for the well-being of the planet, even beyond our own interest, then, and if we somehow understand God's power to be in with and under ours, then what does that call for us to do?
Conversion.
That power. Yes.
Boris. innocent suffering and redemption.
Mm-hmm.
The paradigm of both innocent suffering and redemption is Christ on the cross. In that instance, innocent suffering was redemption. Both before that and after that, there has been innocent suffering, not usually on the scale of 6 million Jews,
yes,
perhaps, but 2 million Cambodians since,
yeah,
then. God has not delivered the martyrs from,
mm-hmm,
their innocent suffering from the time of Stephen or before that till now. And I suppose not identifying that much more closely with that 6 million than with any other 6 million,
mm-hmm,
I don't see that as the turning point to the extent that these authors do, but I do see a turning point in the real possibility of ultimate destruction as a result of possible human action. And as a result of possible human action by those who say outright that they believe that doing that could indeed be doing the will of God,
mm-hmm,
and in the name of Christ.
Yeah.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
The point which I find most disturbing about this is the idea that the ultimate triumph of goodness, of life and good over death and evil, is not certain. I think that in light of possibilities with nuclear destruction,
mm-hmm,
that the outcome of history on a human level is certainly uncertain.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't intend it quite that.
To be sure.
On the other hand, I guess I would at least like to say that if we completely mess it up, that that doesn't rule out God's possibilities. And that if in history life and good do not ultimately triumph, then beyond history, that God's purpose will not finally be defeated by human stupidity and obstinacy.
A Jew would have a very difficult time talking about beyond happening beyond history. We wouldn't know what that would be. I mean, it couldn't be anything the likes of which we know. Or I should say, many would. There's great varieties with the. The question becomes here then the relationship of the Holy Spirit and the human spirit again, and human agency. Yeah.
To me, following on what Jim was saying, the issue is not that the relation of God to reality and the relation of humans to divine purpose has changed. Well, what's changed is something on the level of magnitude. We're dealing with, first of all, with small tribes in early Israel, and then cities, and then empires, and then really big empires, and now we're dealing with planets.
Yeah.
In terms of that relationship of God and God's purpose to human agency, it seems that we really are still located in the same place where God is not a puppeteer, but has drawn humans by God's choice into the creative redemptive act. And that is a power in the hands of humans, but it's a given power. It's derived from the human point of view, from God. So that in itself does not deny God's ultimate providence. But in antiquity as in now, in the Old Testament as now, it seems to me that in the covenantal relationship, humans really can make a difference. However, the difference again is one of magnitude. In the case of the destruction of Jerusalem, it destroyed a whole nation. And the Book of Lamentations sounds very much, I think, like the response of Hiroshima or Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
It's total. It's total negation of God's purpose with God's people. And they really pour out incredible deep feelings about that it's all over. And that if there's a new beginning, it has to be a new creation. However, what's changed is the level of magnitude. It was a city, a nation then, now it could be a whole planet.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how the world has expanded, and our consciousness has expanded. And to me, it's very easy, given what we know now of the expanding universe, to picture our planet Earth the size of what Jerusalem would have appeared to in that time.
That's true.
And so I really, conceptually, do not see how ontologically things have changed. Simply it's changed in terms of the size of things as we perceive them.
But with what you're saying, if God has indeed given us choices, he has also chosen to put himself in impotent position.
Yeah.
So there are things that God cannot do now. And that's something I think...
Has that changed?
At least from... I don't think it has changed, but I don't think... well, at least, I guess I speak for myself. I know as a, growing up and in my own Christian thought, God can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not true.
No. But my thinking has changed in that same way. Yeah. But it's changed in my interpretation of ancient Israel as well as our situation today.
Yeah, I would agree that it isn't an immediate change, but the
perception.
As you said, the perception, the magnitude, the possibilities. And that, the power that we have because of choice is phenomenal. We talk about starving in Africa. I have a choice. And because God's given me a choice, or given us as a church a choice, it puts him in a position where he can't just step in and decide, well, okay, you didn't do it, I'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
Power that we have is scary, and I would agree with this lady. I don't really like all that power. I'd rather not be responsible. Yeah, let God do it.
I think if there's a real danger, it's that we become so enamored of ourselves, of our intellectual abilities, and our into thinking that we are doing it, and we forget God and forget to be humble and realize that even our aptitudes are gifts from God, and that they should be used in such a way that it's for the fulfillment of man, not for destruction.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift this a bit now, and I guess it's probably it's an occupational hazard with me, since I teach Christian ethics, to always come down to what do we do? And that question, one can properly sketch the continuities, one can talk about a process of co-creation, one can acknowledge the reality of increased human power with the attendant dangers and the attendant possibilities, one can characterize our time. But I need to be more specific. We need to be more specific. If this much human power is in human hands, if this is the kind of world of which we're a part, if this is the kind of world of which God is a part, then what are the characteristics of the power that we ought to be wielding? If you were to ask, what is God struggling for amidst the use of human power? What specific things would you point to? What would that look like? Jerry?
This sounds altogether strange, but it seems to me that it does lead in concrete directions. I'm thinking of breaking down the dividing walls of hostility.
Uh-huh.
What's it possible for us to do, not only at an interpersonal level, but in reaching across the chasms to the stranger, the other, the enemy?
Yeah.
What is it that we can do to live out an enlarged hospitality?
Yeah.
For creation.
A great old biblical theme.
Yeah, but it seems to me those do lead in the direction of actions.
Yes, And, I mean, the analysis that we drew on earlier is an analysis which virtually begs for that kind of response. That is, increased human power in a smaller, tighter, more interdependent world. That the book that I shared a little bit from last night, Walter Winck's on Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa, has a provocative statement in the chapter that we never got to, namely a theological statement of Jesus' kind of power, where Walter says that if for the Reformation, justification of the ungodly was the way of talking about God's presence and power, in our time, it's justification of the enemy. That is to say, the how one treats the enemy becomes the litmus test of the presence and the power of God in us, in our time. And I just think that there's a whole lot there. I mean, whether one draws on the great theme of hospitality or stranger or sojourner, or you began by citing Ephesians 2, that the peace is made through the cross by overcoming the hostility, the barriers between peoples who are at odds with one another.
I think for me, one of the really frightening, sobering things that I seem to be seeing comes out of what Winck is looking at in South Africa. It's somehow the kind of evil that's manifest in that system and in the military police and the actions seems to represent the kind of power that could defeat God's desire for good.
Mm.
Unlike, you know, somehow King's actions and Gandhi's actions finally did work something in terms of creative change and possibility, but I really wonder.
Mm-hmm.
It sobers me to think about making any kind of proposals to South African blacks.
Because of the concentration of power, you mean, in the hands of the military and the information systems?
Right.
And the... Well,
that could defeat God's.
We don't need to make proposals. They're making the proposals that Walter Winck goes to observe and then comes back here and tries to revivify our languishing faith by the example of those people.
Yeah.
We're going to Central America, South America, and you know, recalling the statement that some of this sort of crescent of women are making here, that may sound kind of conventional. They're pleading for retaining an idea of God's providence, God being in control, the Spirit still directing. That sounds kind of archaic, maybe, but it seems to me that where in the world we see strength coming, you know, on this level of action, of really involving, of not being passive, but being God's agent, the theology informing this action is this traditional faith.
True.
That we are not defeated because God ultimately is control and God's purpose will prevail. Now that you've shifted to that level, the practical, ethical level of what do we do, there we can re-raise that question of what kind of symbolism can motivate action. And I would just throw out that far more able to motivate action, to be responsible partners of God, is traditional belief in God's providence than an idea of now total lonely human empowerment and responsibility.
I mean, that's true for the movements. That was true for the black churches.
And if it's true for the movements, is it true for truth? What are our criteria for truth, you know? Are they our latest hypotheses at Union or Yale?
At Union.
Notice that dualism. Or is it where we actually see God manifest in activity, in action?
Well, the latter, of course.
That's conceding a lot.
Yes.
I think the whole thing is inseparably vain. We've never been able to pull anything off like this. Any utopia we ever created failed.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Christian's calling has always been to do what you can, as much as you can, and know that whatever you do in the next generation, the problem will be something different. There's diphtheria in my grandparents' time, there's child abuse in my time. We have to fight for what's good.
Mm-hmm.
We have no ways well, we fight for what's good, knowing that we're not going to win. There's the devil and everybody else and all these evil people around that are going to mess it all up, and all the grain we ship over someplace else, somebody rips it off. I think it's a daisy path we'd be going down if we tried that.
Thank you. Wise words.
But there needs to be a recognition of the battle. I mean, that's what I hear the rabbi saying, is that at least that there's sometimes the sense is that the battle's already won, and so we don't have to worry about it. I mean, he is at least calling us to some sort of to the battle, to at least enter into the anguish of the burning heaps of children and of what's happening in South Africa. And sometimes all the platitudes about the victory tend to pull us away from the battle, and we just kind of want to wait for the victory parade at the end, and not that's the blacks in South Africa certainly are not at this point ready for the victory parade.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true, and it's in keeping with the end of Paul's session before. Christians have found ways, in Luther's words, of declaring and living by a theology of glory when the reality is and must be a theology of the cross. And you end up then really denying the power and presence of evil, or somehow declaring it doesn't really matter finally in people's lives when it does. Let me just finish, we've got only 5 minutes left, by drawing out a few characteristics of what I think we see as Jesus' power, and asking whether those characteristics are not also characteristics of the kind of exercise of power appropriate to our time. I don't have time to develop each of these, and so I give them to you as provocations for further pursuing the topic that we've taken on. A power that relativizes and challenges present authorities and patterns. I mentioned last night, Jesus lives as though God reigns and no one else has any power over him. The flip side of that is that all other powers are relativized. They are called into question. They are challenged. They may be valid, but they are only provisionally valid. It is good in our time to relativize the powers, human powers, our own powers. Second characteristic of Jesus' power, a power that creates alternative communities across boundaries that divide people. That's exactly what Jerry was talking about. The creation of communities across boundaries that divide people, whether those are boundaries of race, of class, of gender, of nation, of whatever. Another way of declaring what Paul declares, that in Christ there aren't these boundaries, but they must be, alternative communities must be realized. Thirdly, a power that goes first to the places where the flaws of human community are most evident, and there taps power people did not imagine could be theirs. That is so characteristic of what you see happening in the Jesus movement. Jesus goes to the places where the flaws of human community are most evident. Not they're present everywhere, but it's to the ill, it's to the lame, it's to the marginalized, it's to the imprisoned, it's to the powerless. And that's where you see the truth of some of the dynamics of human community that you don't otherwise see. And there taps power that people did not imagine could be their own. Fourthly, a power that moves with the awesome force of compassion, overcoming by undergoing, and winning new space in the world by letting go. So much of power is power by way of force or coercion, but there is a vulnerable kind of power, a power that moves by compassion, that overcomes and changes relationships by undergoing whatever it needs to be undergone to effect that change. A power that lives by intrinsic sanctions rather than extrinsic sanctions, that we, a power that we consent to from our being. The word in Greek for the authority with which Jesus spoke, when it says Jesus spoke with authority, not as the scribes and Pharisees, that word in Greek is exousia. It means literally out of being. The people heard something that rang true deep in their own being, their own souls. So it was a power that resonates with what is there, rather than extrinsic sanctions. You change your behavior because you must, or you will be punished. So it's a power that lives through the consent of one's whole being. And then a power of suffering gentleness, so tenacious that it will not rest until all of creation flourishes. Does not want to break a bruised reed or quench a smoldering wick, but is so tenacious that it simply is impatient until creation flourishes. Now, that is not all power. Those characteristics, and we could go on, does not represent all power. That's rare power, and it's precious power. But I think for our time, it's saving power, that kind of power. So often we come to social power with the wrong question. We ask the question that Luther and others have asked, can you run society with the gospel? Can you rule with the Sermon on the Mount? And we quickly move to the answer, which is no, you can't. We realize that power as coercion, power as domination, power as force, is a social necessity, and that the gospel's kind of power and cross power is of another order. But we should be posing a different, slightly different question, even though it's a first cousin. Given the limits of coercive power and the power of domination, given the limits of those kinds of power to heal and to save and to change people and teach us the morally responsible use of power, given those limits, secondly, taking note of the escalating powers in human hands today for both beauty and terror, the question ought to be, can we live without the kind of power that you see in Jesus? Rather than the question, can you run society with the gospel? Can you live without that kind of power as a different kind of power working amidst the power power that does need to resort to coercion. Okay, that will have to suffice. I have tried to put these two words together, Jesus and power. It's been an exploratory effort, necessarily modest. Dan Erlander says that he has lowered his expectations when he does Bible studies. When he does a Bible study on the book of Revelation, he has lowered his expectation from hoping that everybody gets the message in the book of Revelation to the single goal that he hopes people will quit saying Revelations and start saying Revelation. My goal has to be, considering I'm just starting to explore this myself, modest on about the same scale. All I've wanted to do is talk of Jesus and power together and ask how they might belong together in our day, and I hope that that has been provoked.
You have spoken with exousia.
Thank you. Now let's do whatever else we need.